ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Picture this. You're travelling in Japan and this message comes on the TV at the train station. Unless you happen to be fluent in Japanese, that probably doesn't mean much to you. However, if you had someone there to translate, they'd tell you it's an emergency earthquake warning and they'd tell you a tsunami alert has been issued and you need to evacuate now. It's vital information for your safety. And for many migrants in regional Australia, a language barrier is preventing them from receiving essential communications.
It's very hard to get any information of anything emergency like that.
Soon, we'll head to regional Victoria, where there are calls for greater investment into interpreter training programs so that no one is left in the dark. I'm Alex Simon, and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk country, Perth. We start in Victoria, where locals in the city of Shepparton, in the state's north, have raised concerns about the prevalence of vaping among the community's youth. It was one of the key issues discussed at a local hearing of a state parliamentary inquiry into vaping and tobacco controls this week. Local schools and students spoke about the impact the issue has been having, with one school captain telling the inquiry that some high school students know at least 10 people they can buy a vape from. Our Shepparton reporter Callum Marshall has the details.
A Victorian inquiry is currently looking at matters such as the financial, health, social and environmental impacts of vaping and tobacco use across the state, as well as the adequacy of state and federal legislation about the issue. It comes as the Victorian government prepares to introduce legislation this year that will require tobacco retailers and wholesalers to obtain a license to sell tobacco products in the state. At a Shepparton hearing of the inquiry, some local schools said they had spent tens of thousands of dollars on vaping detectors. Following the hearing, the ABC spoke with locals about vaping use.
The hype about it, I guess. Wanted to see how it was. If it was better than smoking cigarettes or not. And I don't think it is. Don't do it. It's just going to ruin your lungs faster than cigarettes will.
Well, I thought this was supposed to be the smartest generation, mate, but obviously I was wrong.
I don't like it. When people vape and you don't know they're vaping, you're walking behind them, or you get a whole heap of smoke in your face. I don't think it's good for anybody. I said to my 14-year-old grandson, do not do it. He's at the age where you try everything and start smoking. I said, don't.
I reckon it's stupid, to be honest. Hey, it's addictive. My mother does it, I hate it. My brother does it. Just can't stand it. Like, I can't see it being any better than smoking, to be honest.
It's not working, making it legal, because you can still buy them. I haven't got an answer for it. It's just out of control at the moment.
Local groups have also raised concerns about vaping, including Primary Care Connect, a not-for-profit that provides health and well-being support to community members. CEO Trish Quibell says more data is needed about vaping.
Most of what we know about vaping is quite anecdotal, and we know that we have significant issues with the availability of vapes from under the counter. We are very rarely, if ever, seeing clients who are using vapes on prescription. They're actually using them because of more of a social context and within the social groups, particularly for young people that we see, where it's unfortunately the risk is that it becomes a norm.
You raised some really interesting statistics around use of tobacco or vaping in general. What were, I guess, some of those kind of important statistics you were highlighting?
Some of the statistics that we're seeing is that a number of the young people that we're seeing in our youth program actually don't identify vaping as their primary concern, as a number of them have already been either utilising cannabis or cigarettes, so vaping is not seen as a significant issue. Similarly, we're not seeing anyone coming through our service who's over the age of 18 that wants to address vaping because they're coming into our AOD program to address harder drugs or drugs of more significant addiction. So therefore, they feel they need to continue to hold on to something. So they hold on to their smoking or their vaping in order to give up a different drug.
Could you delve into a little bit more about some of those fascinating points regarding as you speak to those adults over 18s who are looking to detox off of, whether it be obviously harder drugs, that there is still a value for them in terms of being able to vape or smoke, even obviously the significant health impacts to those?
Yeah, I think for a lot of the clients that we see, their levels of addiction to the harder drugs, so-called harder drugs, is that they feel the need to hold on to something in order to, whether it's because of a habit or because of just, you know, it's what they do. They'll get up in the morning and have their coffee, have a smoke at the same time. You can't give up everything at once. So when we take a harm minimisation approach for them, the harm minimisation is that they might give up a harder drug or a harder drug addiction and keep their vaping or their smoking for the moment. It's too much to consider giving up everything. And as my colleague Deb mentioned in the hearing, for most of the rehab and detox facilities in Victoria at the moment are actually non-smoking as well. So we do anecdotally see clients coming through that are reluctant to go into detox or into a rehab facility if they can't smoke as well. It's just too much for them at all at once.
And so these are important things that you're wanting the inquiry committee to consider when we're looking at final recommendation?
Absolutely. I don't think there is ever going to be a single course of action that will address vaping and tobacco issues within Victoria. It's very much a staged and a nuanced approach that needs to go from primary school levels up into secondary and then into adults. And the variety of different mechanisms by which we promote giving up vaping or tobacco products is going to be different for each of those age groups, and how we approach it, whether it's for multicultural communities or Aboriginal communities, or whether people are young people or older people, they'll all have different motivations. So whilst licensing and the opportunities that have come out of that are being legislated at the moment or recommended for legislation will have an impact, it is only one opportunity, and we can't lose sight of multiple pathways that we need to take to address the issue across the community.
That's the CEO of Primary Care Connect, Trish Quibble, speaking with Shepparton reporter Callum Marshall. And the inquiries committee is expected to report its findings by November.
ABC Australia-wide.
Bushfire fighting and fire management are always evolving, and that's certainly the case in a changing climate. Today in Canberra, the International Fire Behaviour and Fuels Conference kicked off. This is a forum where past fire management experience and the lessons learned are explored and shared in a hope of developing solutions as climate change drives a more unpredictable bushfire environment. The conference is taking place concurrently in Boise in Idaho in the United States and Tralee in Ireland. So the keynotes are streamed in between each location. Trevor Howard is the Vice President of the International Association of Wildland Fire, and he is involved in the organising of the conference. Trevor, thanks so much for speaking to Australia-wide. Firstly, I just want to ask, Tralee, Ireland, Boise, Idaho, why have these three locations been chosen to come together to host this conference?
Well, I think for a number of reasons. Boise, Idaho is in a very fire-prone environment. You would have known about some of the large fires in North America. I'm just not talking about the United States, but Canada, obviously, last year was a significant fire season for them. So Boise is very well located in terms of all of those North American resources, in terms of scientists and policymakers and practitioners, and they've got a lot to contribute and always have for a long time. Australia, being a very fire-prone environment, we have some of the best scientists and practitioners in the world, really. So we've got a lot of information and knowledge and expertise to share. And of course, Tralee in Ireland is probably unusual in many ways, but we're starting to see the impacts of climate change in Northern Europe these days. Southern Europe, many people are aware of the Mediterranean areas and the fires that they have in Portugal and Greece and those areas. But you know, across Northern Europe now, we're seeing fires in places where we haven't seen them in the past. And all around the world, we're seeing bushfires now burning through the night in places where they haven't previously, longer fire seasons. So it's becoming a global issue. So there aren't too many places left on the planet now that don't experience bushfires these days. And this is a good opportunity for all of the experts to come together in different locations and share their knowledge and experience and start to grapple with some of the issues for the future.
So is this the aim of the conference, the idea that a problem shared is a problem halved?
Very much so. And a lot of the problems now are not just around the fires themselves, but, you know, how do we use new technology, the technology obviously for, you know, forecasting weather events or for, you know, communicating with the public in a timely manner. It's all changing. New technologies and innovations are being developed all the time, and we need to make sure that we're at the cutting edge, and that we can also make sure that those technologies are actually effective, so that we can actually make sure that, you know, we can keep the public safe, we can educate the public about living in fire-prone environments. And this is an opportunity to not just bring scientists and practitioners together, but even look at some of the latest technologies.
So what can Australia learn from other countries, such as Ireland and the United States? I know we certainly do use their firefighters. We use some of their aerial services with our big bushfire seasons. What else can we learn when it comes to fire management?
Well, I think just for example, in the United States, I mean, they've had many, many big fires for quite a long period of time now, certainly in the western parts of the United States, but they're starting to see it elsewhere across the country. And they've had a lot of experience with you know, managing the impacts, managing the recovery period after major wildfire events, and some of the, you know, community engagement issues, some of the technology they're using to reach out to people and warn them about things. I think there's a lot of developments over there that I think we can learn from and apply in our own situation over here, and perhaps adapt some of the ways that we do things. So it's a very complex business that we're in, and we often need to be sort of reaching out and looking beyond our own backyard to see what other people are doing. And there's always gems of wisdom and new innovations out there that we can borrow and adapt and share.
So today was day one of a three-day conference. What were some of the key topics discussed today?
We've had actually quite a mix of things today. We've had people covering aerial firefighting and the effectiveness of that, and a really good case study from Canada. We had the US Fire Administrator do a keynote address this morning. She spoke very powerfully about some of the lessons that they've learnt in the United States, including the wildfire in Hawaii that did a lot of very major impacts. And that was a good opportunity to also find out about some of the things that are happening overseas at the policy level as well, in terms of how the government collectively is responding to some of these challenges. So it's been a very wide-ranging program today. We've covered community engagement issues and risk management, and that's just really set the foundation for the next couple of days, which are going to be quite diverse again in terms of the program.
Are fire management methods generally quite location-specific? Are there techniques that are broadly applicable across the different countries, things that we can apply that people are looking at, senior firefighting management are looking at and going, oh, we should be using that here?
Look, I think there are, but getting back to the local places, I think what's really important is we actually need to tailor a lot of our messages so that the public and the people who actually live in rural communities and even urban communities these days can actually understand what bushfires and wildfires can do, so that they can actually start preparing themselves. And a lot of that local community-based knowledge is really, really important, so that a lot of the big fire management strategies, be it use of aircraft or incident management teams or whatever, you know, obviously very important and very powerful and very effective, but getting the community to understand what they can do before the bushfire breaks out and even during the bushfire, and how they can actually prepare their properties and themselves, and how they can reach out to their friends and family and support them. All of those local community actions are actually very, very important. And I think there's a lot of work we can do in that space to improve things.
As far as making preparations ahead of time, one issue that often gets a pretty strong reaction here in Australia is prescribed burning. Is that something that will be discussed over the course of the conference?
Absolutely. That's going to be discussed at quite a few of our sessions over the next couple of days. And what's also going to be discussed is just what we can learn from Indigenous people as well, because, yeah, certainly there's been some debates about prescribed burning, and there probably always will be. That's the nature of science. But there's just so much we can learn from Indigenous people, not just in Australia, but around the world as well, because, you know, they've been living in fire-prone environments and using fire and managing their own cultures and communities and managing their resources and food requirements in ways that have been going on for thousands of years. And there's just so much we can learn from them. And over the next couple of days, we'll be hearing quite a bit more about that topic in Australia, and having a keynote speaker tomorrow talking about his experience in Western Arnhem Land and some of the lessons learned from that. So, yeah, there's some very powerful messages around prescribed burning, and I think it's something we're really starting to embrace more in Australia, despite the debates. I think the Indigenous knowledge and the Indigenous perspectives are really starting to shape our knowledge and understanding of living in this country.
So given the international nature of this conference, is it now, I guess, an understanding that fire seasons, bushfire fighting, it seems that one, that they're almost overlapping globally, and that really this is an acknowledgement that it's a team effort globally to help manage this going forward?
Absolutely, Alex. Like even, for example, last year, I mean, we sent a lot of firefighters from Australia to Canada. It was the largest ever international deployment from this country. Countries now are just starting to exchange firefighters and exchange resources on a more regular basis, and I think we're going to see a lot more of that. And obviously we're going to have major fire seasons in Australia in future years, as we've done in the past, and certainly a lot of our colleagues and counterparts in other countries will come to help us, just as we've gone to help them. So I think there's a global sharing of resources, and that's very good. We're actually learning from each other in the process and improving the way we do things based on our experience with other countries as well. So there's a lot of challenges that we face with climate change and things like that, but certainly in terms of cooperating across the globe and learning and sharing from each other, I think that's in a very good place, and I think it's improving a lot.
Trevor Howard is the Vice President of the International Association of Wildland Fire, and he's been speaking to us here on Australia Wide. Trevor, all the very best for the remainder of the conference, and thanks so much for chatting to us.
Thanks very much, Alex.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
And you are with me, Alex Hyman. It's great to have your company. More than 250,000 Victorians speak English not well or not at all. That's according to the 2021 census. And it's resulted in more community volunteer leaders translating essential communications for growing migrant populations, particularly in regional areas like Mildura in the state's northwest. One of those volunteers is Flora Walter, a member of the Malaysian community in the region, who's become a vital source of information for her networks. As reporter Emil Pavlich finds out, there are calls for greater recognition and more translating and interpreting training across regional Australia.
Mereka yang belum ada nama dalam senarai ini sila tunggu ya, sebab masih ramai lagi orang yang tunggu untuk mendapatkan suntikan di Mildura, bukan grup kita sahaja. Tolong faham.
That's Flora Walter speaking in Bahasa Malaysia, the official language of the country of the same name. However, she's not in Malaysia. She's in the regional Victorian town of Mildura, where there's a growing diaspora numbering over 1,000 people. She's reading out a message posted to a WhatsApp group where she translates important information, including where to get vaccines or what to do in an emergency. And she does it all volunteer.
I reckon if there's no WhatsApp group, it's very difficult for them because it doesn't cost anyone to use those type of social media. And that's very important. And they're comfortable to communicate in those kind of way, you know. That's pretty much how we communicate.
Mrs. Walter manages the local neighbourhood house as a full-time job, but also volunteers casually as a community leader for the local multicultural organisation. According to a government multicultural guide published late last year, 1 in 10 Malaysians in Australia say they speak English not well or not at all.
Most of the Malaysian people that settle in Mildura or come here, like, they're seasonal workers. So it's very hard to get any information of anything emergency like that.
The local multicultural organisation, or SMEC, relies heavily on the translating and interpreting service to reach out to the non-English speaking communities in the region. In some cases, SMEC also pays its bilingual workers to do formal interpreting. However, running a WhatsApp group is not a formal program that has secured any funding.
They should be looking for some sort of government funding. We're not talking about the big funding, but at least to cover our cost to go out there and fuel and things like that. We should look at that way to help us, and we're happy to help our community.
Monash University research affiliate Dr. Margarita Angelucci coordinated a project in Shepparton last year called Interpreting, Mentoring and Professional Advancement Regional Opportunities, or IMPARO for short. It looked at how multicultural communities rely on unofficial channels for information, particularly in regional areas where resourcing is more difficult. Dr. Angelucci said one of the takeaways from the project was that there was a lack of professional translators and interpreters in the Shepparton region, and that in many cases, non-professionals needed to step in.
What we suggest is not for government to invest in these volunteering practices that we are seeing on the ground. On the contrary, we would argue that it's important to support further training opportunities that would take people who are now kind of filling the gaps and acting as translators and interpreters in an informal way, to then take these people to be able to study these professions and then get certified.
The National Accreditation Authority for Translators and Interpreters, or NATI for short, is responsible for accrediting language practitioners and was a partner in Dr. Angelucci's project. She said there was a lot of upfront costs before translators could become accredited as professionals through NATI.
Before you can even start earning money in that profession, and of course, especially for people who might be new arrivals in the country, it's all very, very difficult to enter in that space. First of all, to have the knowledge about how this system works in Australia, and then to have the means to be able to afford this can be a little bit classist.
NATI National Operations Manager Michael Nemrich said in a statement to the ABC that since 2021, the organisation's been offering professional certification as an online option to those in regional and rural areas. Tests can also be subsidised for eligible participants in the program by as much as half the cost of delivery and marking. But Mr. Nemirich said the fees can still be high for some people wanting to do the course, particularly those from low socioeconomic backgrounds.
So that's what it translated. So that's SEHS group.
Flora Walter said many within her Malaysian community felt most comfortable hearing important information from her, as she's a trusted member of the community and she believes the social media format works.
Sometimes you blame technology, but if you use it in the right way, then the technology is benefit for us.
That was Flora Walter, ending that report by Emil Pavlich in Mildura in regional Victoria. And finally here on Australia Wide, let's end in Queensland. Witnessing a pack of drovers on horseback moving hundreds of cattle across the country doesn't exactly sound like a common sight in 21st century Australia. But out in rural Queensland, near a little town called Idswold, the cattle drive is still very much alive. It happens every 2 years and it's a chance to experience droving on the old stock routes. And Saturday saw it wrap up again until 2026. Our reporter Ross Kay headed out to the action and spoke with drover Sandra Williamson.
We have a fantastic herd of cattle. It's the most cattle that we have driven since the inception of this idea, and they were fantastic. And Idswold had lovely rain, and there was beautiful grass and water along the way, so it was really a lovely, enjoyable drove this time.
And you're the best judge of that too, because you've been on every Idswold cattle drive.
Yes, I come over because I'm not that far away, only over a couple of hills and mine hullocks sweeps, yes, that's right. And no, I enjoy it. The country's definitely different from Marraway. Marra's a little more sort of, say, flatter, but I really enjoy riding in this lovely country over here.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Do you bring your own horse?
Oh, yes. Everybody supplies their own horse on the drive, and it's a lovely time to spend that week with your animal, riding him every day, and you get to know each other more and more, you know, as the ride progresses, because with more work, your horse becomes more amicable to you and is more than happy to do as he's told for once. And it's a really satisfying feeling. In this instance, I happened to be riding a standard bred. He obviously raced in harness. Like all racing horses, you can pick them up for not much money, but you do have to put a bit of work in them. And to make them rideable, he'll get in and help with the cattle as he'll sort of bite them and put his ears back and let them know to keep moving on and save a bit of work. And no, I really enjoyed riding him. He's an easy horse to ride. He doesn't wear you out like some horses will for the day. But no, I'm really thankful for him.
So have you already signed up for next time?
Well, yeah, I'm hoping there's a next time. But there is a two-year gap between rides, which is a very good idea. I think it's a terrible lot of work for the people and behind the scenes. It's okay for us drivers. We come along and just live the easy life. But the people who have created this idea, they really do the hard yards. The cattle have got to be prepared beforehand, got to make sure that they're right for green riders and horses, that they can be handled through most anything. That's how it is. Yeah.
So what would be your bit of advice to someone who's thinking, maybe I'll have a go if they do hold it again, I might have a go myself. Why should they do it?
Well, ideally, if you and your horse are not on the same page, it is a great week for you and your horse to get to know each other and become one, because it's every day you're riding, maybe 5-6 hours a day, maybe 7, and your horse, all of a sudden he becomes a different animal to ride, and all of a sudden riding is a pleasure. So that's about how it is. Yeah, there's nothing nicer than, you know, being at one with your horse. It's just like most animals, you know, if you're on the same page, it's great. It's great to be alive, yeah.
That's drover Sandra Williamson chatting with our reporter Ross Kay there about the Eidsvold cattle drive that's just finished up for another 2 years. It sounds like a fantastic time. And that is Australia-wide for this Tuesday. I'm Alex Hyman. I'll be back again with you tomorrow. I hope you can join me then. Have a wonderful evening. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.